how many of you enjoy history? Just kind of raise your hands a little bit. All right, so you will enjoy this morning. The rest of you might, you'll fall asleep and you'll pick it up and it'll be like you're at school and that'll be fine. But the other two questions I really want to ask you, and I'm not baiting you into anything, I'm just curious. How many of you love the picture of, like, God is love and loves you and all of that spectacular conversation? Just kind of raise your hands. And like, okay, some of you didn't raise your hands, so you obviously are on the, like, the angry God side of the coin. So how many of you like the God of justice or wrath or punishment? Raise your hand. All right, so not as many. How many of you find the kind of the other side of that conversation difficult? So if you're like an all God love time, and then all of a sudden there's a conversation of God's wrath, you're like, ooh, I don't like that. Like, you find that difficult. Just kind of raise your hand. All right. So you are in for a treat, because we're working through these two themes, God's love and God's wrath, his justice. And you need to hear this. They go hand in hand with one another. They are not divorced from each other. You cannot have one without the other. These are wedded together in profound ways that point to one of the great, well, the greatest act of love that you could possibly fathom, that you and I are the beneficiaries of, this side of Calvary, this side of the cross, this side of Jesus' life and death. So kind of with that in mind, last week I kind of told a story of my mom, who at moments in kind of raising us as children would have this moment, and if you're a mom, you'll know this, where it's kind of that moment when no one's listening to her. We just continue to be 16-year-old obnoxious punk teenage boys, and my mom would say, "My patience is up to here." Like, kind of that, like, this was the last straw that we had kind of driven through every yield sign, every red light. We just paid no attention to mom, and this was like the things are going to shake down real fast now, pending our response to my mother's, "My patience is up to here now." And all of it is connected to who I am to my mom. I am her son. She is my mom. There is a right and a responsibility as mom to play out all kinds of things on me, pending my response to, "My patience is up to here." There were moments when I heeded the warning and I stopped doing what I was doing, said I was sorry. And it was amazing how fast mom would go from, I'm going to kill you, to, "You're my son." And hugs and loves, and like nothing had happened. It blew my mind that she could go from, like, I'm at a moment now where, like, you're almost kind of out of the home kind of anger, to, "Let's go get ice cream." Like, it baffled me as though nothing had happened. And again, that response is because of who I am to her, her son. There were times, believe it or not, I know, I'm pretty spectacular, where I did not heed her warning. And we just drove through the red light. We just drove through the, "My patience is up to here." And as we got older, I felt for my mom. Like, I was this big in grade 7. I was not this heavy, but I was this tall. My older brother Paul, my brother David, we were giant men in our home. And my mom's not. And in these moments of, we just drove through the red light of, "My patience is up to here," we have come to affectionately call it and look back on it now. And if you're a parent now, you're like, "Is this allowed?" Then, I'm not sure, but it was done anyway. So mom would, we call it the knuckle. Like, she could, out of nowhere, after just being an idiot, walk by, bang, like, crack the wrist, one knuckle across the back. And we're like, "Ugh!" And it hurt a lot. A lot. And out of this generally pretty peaceful, gracious woman came a kind of wrath that was surprising and painful because of who I am to her. She didn't do this on the stranger's kids or the visiting kids, just on me, her son. This story I want you to kind of hold in your mind as we move into chapter 16 of the story. We've been working through this since September. And in chapter 16, we run into the two kings of Israel, one in the northern kingdom, one in the southern kingdom. Two sons of God, two men that God has created and authored and fashioned for certain things. And these two sons of God, King Hosea and Hezekiah, both of them are at that moment where God's saying, my patience is up to here. Both of them are here in this moment. Both of these men, their kingdoms that they rule over, are in league with the Assyrian kingdom that's to the north of them. Both of them have adopted Assyrian religious practices. Both of them are in full-on rebellion against God and what he had in mind for his people. Now, before we go any further, I want to describe the Assyrians to you. The Assyrians, dating back to 700 BC, they had a reputation of being an incredibly dark, militarily vicious people. In the 19th century, archaeologists found a tablet that had inscriptions from one of the Assyrian kings describing what they did to people who were not Assyrians. And here are the words recorded on a stone tablet from one of the Assyrian kings remarking about a battle that they had just come through. He says, we dyed the mountain as red wool with the blood stain of enemies. We have impaled them on stakes. I have skinned them and have spread their skins on the walls of their cities. I sliced their hands, their fingers, their noses, their ears. I tore out their eyes. I cut their heads. I stacked them to form pillars. The Assyrians had an incredibly interesting religious life. And by interesting, I mean awful, like terrible religious practices as they served a variety of gods that required human sacrifice, all kinds of awful practices. And this is the kingdom that God's people have aligned themselves with. And God's patience is up to here with the northern kingdom. King Hosea does not respond to God's warning. He does not respond to the prophets that God has been sending to the northern kingdom for now 200 years. Like, this is not my mom on an afternoon that gets frustrated. This is 200 years of God warning, please don't do this. This ends bad for you. Please stop. And they just continually do their own thing, which invokes the knuckles. God allows Sargon II, who is king of Assyria, to go in and absolutely lay waste to his own people, the Israelites. Hosea and the rest of Israel are destroyed. They are exiled out of the kingdom, out of the northern kingdom, and they are deported. Some 30,000 Israelites are now forced to live in the furthest regions of the Assyrian Empire. And deportation started right here. This is where this methodology of what we do with vanquished foes is born out of Assyrian war strategies. And the hope would be you take the Israelite, put them in the far corner of the Assyrian world, and in a matter of years, they've been stripped of all dignity, all sense of who they were as a people, and they will just become like one of us in time, robbing them of all of their uniqueness that God had made them to be. God allows this to happen because they refuse to listen to his warning. Now, while this is happening, there is another king, King Hezekiah in the south. Hezekiah is not yet king. His dad is still there. His name Ahaz. He is not a nice king, a very evil king in a variety of ways. Ahaz, he dies. Hezekiah becomes king. Hezekiah has seen what has happened in the northern kingdom. And he begins very quickly to respond to God's messengers, God's warning that if you keep doing all that I've asked you not to do, it's going to get problematic for you. So Hezekiah goes to work right away, now new as the king of Israel, and he removes all the places of idol worship. He smashes the sacred stones that were needed for child sacrifice. He cuts down the Asherah poles. He takes the bronze snake that they're burning incense to. He destroys that. He holds fast to God, his way of life, his instruction, and God is present to him, walking with him. And this is the part that I want you to see how God actually comes to Hezekiah after he responds to God's warning and turns around. And Assyria, this massive army, is marching down from the north, and it comes right up against the city wall of Jerusalem. So on one side, you have Hezekiah, kind of new king, all the Israelites from the tribe of Judah on the inner wall of the city of Jerusalem. And on the outside, you have what is arguably the most vicious war machine in ancient history. It would be like all of America's army has gathered around Prince Edward Island, and we're like depending on the bridge to keep them out. Like, this would be the kind of fear that would be in the Israelite camp. And what makes matters worse is the king of Assyria sends messengers right to the wall, and he begins to mock the people on the other side. And this is what this is the mocking. It says, "Who are you trusting in now that you've rebelled against us? And don't say the Egyptians, because they're idiots." Essentially what he calls them. And he goes, "And if you're depending on the Lord, you've already made him mad because you've destroyed all the places where you worship. Come and make a deal with us. You have no hope. You have no horsemen. Egypt's not coming. My lowest ranking official can destroy anyone in your army." And this is where it would really hurt. "After all, didn't your God allow us to take the northern kingdom?" Which is true. "Didn't your God allow us to take the northern kingdom?" One of the servants of Hezekiah is terrified. He yells across the wall to the Assyrian messenger and says, "Don't speak in Hebrew. You're scaring our people. Speak in Aramaic so we don't understand your taunts." The Assyrian guy responds, "That's the point. My king has sent me here to speak in your native tongue so that we would terrify you." And he continues on and says, "Soon you will be forced," the word that's in the scriptures is defecate, but it's actually like your crap. He says, "You will eat your own crap, and we will force you to drink your own pee. Have a great afternoon." And that's the terrifying words from the mocking Assyrian army from one side of the wall to the other. And he continues, it gets even worse. He says, "Don't let Hezekiah fool you." So now he's calling out the new king of Israel. "He cannot deliver you from our army. Don't let Hezekiah persuade you to trust in the Lord. Has the God of any nation ever delivered his land from the hand of the Assyrian king? Where are the gods of Hemathah, from Sepharah, from Hena and Iva? How can your God deliver Jerusalem from our hands? What makes it worse is other kings from around the area, the king of Cush, he sends word to Hezekiah as well and says, don't depend on your God. Jerusalem will not withstand the weight of the Assyrian army. You know what the Assyrians have already done to other nations. He destroyed them completely, and their gods did nothing. Where were the gods of Gozan, of Haran, of Rezpah? If you say it fast, it makes you sound like you know what you're talking about. I have no idea. I'm just saying real fast. Where the king of Hamathah and the king of Arphad? Where is the king of Lyre, from Sepharah, from Hena and Iva? And he goes on. Where were the gods helping these people? Don't trust in your God, because you have no hope. Hezekiah's response to all of this, this new king who has turned back to God, his response is simple. He simply goes into the temple of the Lord and he prays this prayer. "Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned between the cherubim, you alone are God over all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Give ear, Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, Lord, and see. Listen to the words of the one that's ridiculing the living God. Deliver us from his hand so that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Lord, our God." That night, after Hezekiah goes to sleep, an angel of the Lord goes into the Assyrian army and kills 185,000 of their men. The king gets up the next day and realizes that they've been overcome by their God, tucked tail, and runs the other way the next day. This is chapter 16 of the story. Two sons of God, two kings over God's people, experience incredibly different outcomes based on their response to God and his warning. One, the knuckle. The other, God's love and grace to them. Here's what I need you to see in my own mom. I am her son. I belong to her. And if I push, and if I push, and I push, and she tells me that the patience is running out, and then I push all through where there is no more patience, she is now just and right to punish and bring wrath on my life. This is true in the story. Hosea and Hezekiah, two sons of God, they belong to God. They have been made by Him. They are serving God in pivotal roles over His people. And if they continue to push and push and push, God is perfectly just in bringing judgment on them. This is what happens to God's son, King Hosea. He refused to turn. He wouldn't listen. And so the judgment comes. Now listen, a lot of you, I can see it in your body language and in the scowl of, I don't like the idea of God's judgment and wrath. And I want to push back and say, actually, you do. You actually do. And here's my example. I didn't see anybody this week recoil at the judge's sentence over Larry Nassar's life. Nobody batted an eye. When the judge says, it is my tremendous honor and privilege to sentence you to 175 years in jail, the world watches, applauds that kind of justice, yes? And if you've lived under a rock lately, this particular guy has assaulted, sexually abused, and harmed 150 different girls over the years as part of the medical staff of the U.S. Olympic gymnastics team. The judge hears all 150 voices of all the things that were done to these young girls. And the world is waiting for, please don't let this guy somehow get away with this. And when justice rolls over Mr. Nassar, there is this like collective, this is right. This is good. This is the way it's supposed to happen. Because of who King Hosea was to God, a created son, God has every right to bring His justice down on him, just like the judge did over Larry Nassar. Now, I also want you to see in my mom how quick she was to forgive and restore when I responded to her, my patience is up to here. It still amazes me how fast things would return to normal, right and good, when I listened and responded to my mom's word of warning. I could and was often found doing things that were completely outside of what mom and dad expected from us as their sons and my sister for their daughter. Small things like language and name calling, general goofing off with my brother David when we hit 12, 13 and we continually broke their stuff because we were just wrestling. Or more relational things, what I would say really mean, hurtful things to my sister or my older brother, or at times even my mom and my father. Things where, as I grew a little bit older, just flat-out rebellion, where I knew what they expected from me and I just didn't care. And I just did it anyway. Regardless of what it is that I was doing that was breaking house rules, the moment I responded to my mom's voice of, this ends bad for you, my son, if you don't turn around, the moment I turned around, it's like it never happened. We instantly went forward. We instantly, there was no like a week of trying to figure out, do you still love me and will I let you live here? Like it was instant, back in the fold, hugs around, and that moment, like we all do it on Facebook, like look how awesome my family is, click, click. But before that picture was like death and war and all of those things, like it was fast to return to that space of goodness with my mom when I responded. This is true in the story. Ahaz, which is Hezekiah's father, was the evil king against God. And the moment that Hezekiah becomes king, he rebels against the Assyrian army, does all that God would ask him to do, and God instantly comes to him. He doesn't wait for Hezekiah to prove it over a period of time. He doesn't make through jump other hoops. God instantly comes to Hezekiah and begins walking with, working for, and does amazing things against the Assyrians the moment that he turns. Why? Because Hezekiah is his son. He longs for him to be in this place. Chapter 16 of the story captures these two very real aspects of God's character. His love, but also his wrath. And in so many moments, these things are actually linked together. And to really drive home the analogy of family, this kind of moves to us. God, out of love for you, for me, takes out all of the justice that is rightfully his to take out against us as his sons and daughters. He takes it all out on your older brother. And you're like, I don't have an older brother. I'm an only kid. Well, you actually do. One of the images that we do not talk about very often is the fact that Jesus is your great older brother. It's all through the pages of Scripture. I want to explain this because this is an amazing picture for you to feel the weight of this morning. But God, because of who we are to him, we are his sons and daughters. God never desires that we actually experience and sit under the weight of his judgment and wrath. This is not his hope for you. It's not his hope for me. But he has to judge. He can't unsee what I've done. I wish he could look back at what I did in grade 12. I wish he could undo what he saw yesterday. I wish he could unsee these things in my life. But he has to judge. He has to be who he is. Imagine how awful it would have been for the judge over Larry Nassar to look at him and say, you're fine. Free to go. No consequence, no punishment. Go back into your job. Can you imagine the outcry from everyone watching in to say, what is this foolishness? If there's a space where we long for justice to come, God is the one who is perfect to bring justice. But he doesn't want you or I to sit under the weight of that because we would explode under the weight of that. So again, because of who we are to him, sons and daughters, he's done something pretty awesome. I'm going to put it up on the screen just so you can see this verse so that you know that I'm not making this up. This is Paul. God did not appoint us to suffer wrath. This is not his hope for you. So God, Father, Son, and Spirit, out of love, goes to work to deal with the issue of justice and wrath that he has to deal with. And your great older brother, the Son, raises his hand and says, I'll go, I'll take it. Like my older brother Paul, as a kid, like it was amazing when like I was getting picked on at Hubbard Avenue School by the older kids. And then I would see Paul recognize what was going on. And like Paul came walking across the playground. I'm like, yes, you are all dead. Because my older brother is coming. I have a greater older brother than Paul. That he willingly said, Phil cannot stand up under the weight of the justice that we have to perform. I'll take it. So my older brother, Jesus Christ, steps in line. The Father pours out all of his justice and wrath that's directed at me. And Jesus says, I'll take it because I can, because I love him, and I don't want him to sit under the weight of this, so I will take it for him. We love the idea of justice. You really do. And when we roll it up into who God is and we see it played out on his son, which rightfully was mine, this is what your older brother has done for you. That you might escape this conversation, this very awkward moment of justice that is perfect all of the time. In a few short moments, we're going to gather around this table. And this is just one of the many faces of what the cross and Calvary is. Yes, it's this, but there's probably 15 to 20 different conversations that we can have of all that took place, that what Jesus did for you and I. One of them is that the older brother said, I will take the heat, I will deal with the judgment, so they have a chance to live and experience life because we love them. One of my favorite verses, in fact, my favorite verse is this next one. And this is a pretty cool picture. The one who makes people holy, which is Jesus Christ. So Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters. So not only did my elder brother like step into the line and take it all, he then looks at me and says, "That's my brother. That's my sister." Like, it's not that he unwillingly did this and now begrudges me that he, like, because my older brother took some shots for me then and kind of like did not enjoy me, the little brother, later on in the day. He's like, "You remember this and you owe me." Like, kind of that weird, like, okay, like I saw what you did to him, so I'll do what you said. Like, kind of that space. Jesus steps into the line and says, "I want to do this. And this is my brother. This is my sister. I'm not ashamed to kind of connect me into his family this way." In a few moments, we're going to gather around this table. I want to ask Gordon and team to come back, and they're going to kind of lead us in a song. But what I find fascinating about this conversation is that for some of you, you struggle with the whole idea of God's wrath and his justice. You struggle with the idea that we might actually be punished for our mistakes. And where I really lose my mind is that some of us think, like, it's all good. Like, there is no consequence for our actions. And you already know that that's not true. You've already experienced the repercussion in consequence, sometimes by no one else at all, just in your own inner life. And all of these things that God looks at me and says, "Phil, you've missed the mark." And I know when I've missed the mark. And then there's a whole list of times that I don't even realize that I've missed the mark. Jesus, my older brother, says, I'll take it all. Because the judge who is perfect has to judge. And I look at my older brother, and I realize just what he has done so that I can live, so that I can have a hope of responding to the Spirit who is warning of what is to come if I don't turn. And the moment that you turn, the moment you turn, the Father walks with you. You don't have to do a weird, like, 6-month probationary period like you do with your bosses at work to find out how good you're going. It instantly comes and begins walking with you. Instantly begins working for you, for your good, for your joy, for all kinds of things, helping you restore and put back together all the spaces that sin and death have brought into our lives. We cannot talk of God's love without talking about God's wrath and his justice, because these things are wed together. Because the greatest act of his love for you was driven by the fact he is a just God and he has to deal with sin as judge. It's just your elder brother said, "I'll take it. I'll take it." Let's pray. Gordon's going to lead us in a song. The servers are going to come. We're going to pass out the elements. And when you have the cup and bread, just sit tight. I'll come back and kind of walk us through here in a moment. Let's pray together. Our gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you so very much for who you are. We thank you so very much the fact that you are a God who is just and perfect in all of your ways. And I'm so thankful that I have an older brother that willingly stepped into the line and said, Phil can't stand up under the weight of what this means for him. But I can, because I love him. Because I love him, and I'm not ashamed to call him my brother. God, I pray that you would speak into our hearts this morning. In your name.